Good afternoon. I am calling the House Special Committee on Energy meeting to order. Today is Thursday, February 26th. The time is 1:35 p.m. Members present are Representative Kopp, Representative Costello, Co-Chair Mears, and myself, Co-Chair Kai Holland. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members and staff that we're allowing members to use electronic devices during the committee meetings, but please silence your cell phones. As a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Tim Truer. He's up here in the corner. And he will take care of it. Thank you to Tim and to co-chair Mears' committee aide, Griffin Plush, who has been instrumental in pulling together a lot of the activities we have today. Before we get started, I'd like to also thank Recording Secretary Cheryl Cole and Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO for technical support for this meeting. Today, we have two items on the agenda. First, we'll be entertaining amendments on House Bill 257, supporting state energy development, sponsored by Representative Eichheit. And for the record, just note that Representative Eichheit has joined us. Thank you, sir. And this is the bill's third hearing. Second, we'll be hearing an introduction of House Bill 369, Energy Electric Utilities, sponsored by this committee. This will be the bill's first hearing. So we'll begin by taking up House Bill 257, Portable Solar Energy Generation Devices, by Representative Eichheit. And for purposes of the amendments, I'm going to be handing the gavel over to Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you very much. So we are on to amendments. Do we have a... And we have some. Co-Chair Holland, do you have a motion?
Great. Chair Mears, I move amendment number one, work order 34-LS1203/A.6.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
Great. Chair and or co-chair and the committee, amendment number one is a amendment that is clarifying the power output of the devices. In the prior bill, it was specifying 1,200 watts. This is simply clarifying that this would be 1,200 watts individually or combined with other portable solar generation devices connected to the same electric meter, so that there's just clarity on how much total power would be allowed under this current bill.
Thank you. I appreciate that amendment. It clarifies a question we had in committee about being able to hook these things up in series. Are there any questions from the committee?
No.
Okay. I'll remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Amendment number one is adopted. Representative Holland.
Thank you, co-chairs. Co-chair Muir, I move amendment number two.
Object.
Thank you. And I think I needed to read in the full amendment work order. That is LS34-LS1203/A.3.
Thank you for the revised motion. Representative Kopp, I assume you still maintain your objection for purposes of discussion?
Yes. I would like to hear that.
Representative Holland?
Great. Thank you. The amendment number two is clarifying that this would not apply to utilities that sell over 5,000 kilowatt hours electricity. So this is essentially exempting it so it doesn't apply to the small utilities.
Any questions from the committee?
The amendment is indicating that this section is not going to apply to utilities that sell 5,000. Excuse me, I think I did misspeak earlier. Thank you for clarifying that. 5 million kilowatt hours or less of electricity So this is essentially ensuring that the portable solar device and the bill that we're looking at would only be applying to larger utilities, with the idea that they could absorb the impact of these small power generating devices. This would not be automatically allowing it for small utilities where there's concern about the impact of creating multiple distributed generation devices.
Would this largely be like a small community? Thank you, Coach Holland. Would this, these types of communities be like the smaller utilities for off-grid communities that have maybe 100 people on the system?
Yes, exactly. I'm trying to recall, I believe 5 million is something on the order of a Bethel, but we're talking about all the smaller ones beyond that.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions from the committee? Representative Kopp, what would you like to do with your objection?
Yes, I remove my objection.
Thank you. Seeing no other objections, amendment number 2 has passed, been adopted. Representative Holland?
Chair Mears, I move amendment 3, work order 34-LS1203/A.4.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Great. Thank you. Amendment number 3 is a clarification that these devices would not be able to energize the power or electrical system during a power outage. That's to say that we don't want a generation device plugged in making power when otherwise the power to that home is dead. That would create a potential risk, particularly for anybody who might be providing service to that house. If you imagine that you wanted to do a home repair and you turned off the fuse to that circuit and thought that you'd turned off the fuse so it was safe to work on, but then were surprised to find out that this panel was putting power onto that. And in a bigger context, if we had a number of homes that had these panels and there was a power interruption and a power line out and you had power line workers, you wouldn't want these systems energizing that local distribution network. So this clarifies that the devices have to have a feature to ensure that they're not putting power on the local circuit or the local grid if there isn't any power there already. So essentially it has to sense that there is power in order to supply power.
Representative Kopp?
Sure. So my memory from the bill sponsor is that at least the types of systems that he was describing have this feature internally, but I think it's good that we specify that that's a requirement.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. And I believe that, you know, as the UL listing is being developed, that will be a feature that's included in it. Yeah. And we'll... Right.
And Co-Chair Mears, we have the bill sponsor here too. I don't know if he'd like to speak to this question.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears, Co-Chair Holland, and members of the committee. So as was discussed in your committee, these devices do already have this automatic shutoff, so they don't send power to a dead circuit, dead outlet. But this was a request from the utility companies to have some redundancy here in the language, and I'm totally happy with that because people's perception safety is important, and this just ensures that these devices are going to be safe.
Thank you, sir. Representative Eichheit, I take that you have no objection to the amendment.
I do not have any objections.
Thank you, Representative Costello.
Thank you, and I appreciate this amendment because that's the discussion that I was having about the safety of these devices, and was just hoping the sponsor of the bill could also talk about are there any known instances that you're aware where there's where this feature doesn't respond the way that it's intended? And I understand that in Germany there are many of these units. Could you talk about the safety record of the units so that's on the record?
Yes, through the co-chair, Representative Costello. So I am not aware of any safety issues. To give context to what you said about the Germany experience, so my understanding is Germany has had these devices for approximately 10 years, a decade, and at this point, it's estimated 4 million domiciles have these devices. I would request if my staffer, Aaron Callahan, could come up here because he's been doing a lot of heavy lifting, and I think he could give you a more accurate answer to your question about are there any known instances.
For the record, Aaron Callahan, staffer, Representative Eichheit, through the chairs. Representative Costello, I have specifically gone looking for unsafe instances on these. In my research, I've not been able to find any documented cases of either backload into the grid causing problems for linemen or touch safety issues on the plugs, both. This line addresses both of those things, and I have not been able to find anything in my research about safety issues.
Thank you.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the co-chair, I do have a question for the sponsor. I think everybody has probably received a copy of a letter from IBEW regarding some concerns about the safety of these devices and this topic I think we're talking about right now, which is the potential of the device to either energize or overload a circuit. And I'm just curious if you have any initial thoughts on that or would like to respond to those concerns that have been raised.
Yeah, thank you, co-chair. So we've talked about that. We've heard the similar concerns. You will note that in the bill it talks about, you know, it being safety certified. And again, I'd like to turn it over to my staffer, but I think there might be an answer to that in the safety standards I just referenced.
For the record, Aaron Callahan. Staff for Representative Eichheit. The simple answer to that question is that systems inconsistent with UL standards are not subject to this legislation. So once the UL standards are published, they will address this. And those any system that is not consistent with their safety standards is not addressed by this bill.
Okay. Thank you for that. I am working on confirming we were going to make sure that letter was posted on BASIS. So I don't know if it is right at the moment, but we'll make sure it's out there for folks to see those concerns.
Thank you, Representative Ruffridge.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Mears, Co-Chair Mears. So I guess on that note, with this idea of safety issues and such, since the underwriting and safety certifications are still in process, if a person is to purchase a solar generation device, a portable one now, and install it, all this bill really is doing is saying that it's exempt from interconnection and net metering requirements. There's nothing about this bill that is requiring some sort of safety standard for portable solar generation devices. I guess I'm a little confused on the line of questioning. The bill does not itself demand some sort of certification. It just says in order to be exempt from the utility interconnection and net metering program requirements, it has to be UL certified. Is that an accurate statement?
Representative Eichheit?
Yeah, I'll let my staff, Aaron Callahan, answer that.
For the record, Aaron Callahan, staff for Representative Eichheit, through the chairs. Representative Ruffridge, the bill at this point does require that to be considered by this bill, the system would be UL certified. So you're correct. Those standards do not fully exist right now. If someone were to install one right now, it would not be subject to the bill. And there are documented installations of these various systems being done right now. So it is a gray area, and that's kind of hits at the heart of part of the reason for this bill.
Follow up, if I may?
Follow up, Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, how certain are you that UL certification is going to happen. Because again, I guess I'm going back to a person still could purchase a non-certified device, install it in any way that they wish to. It's just that this exemption from interconnection and net metering program requirements would just not exist for them. Does that make sense?
Representative, through the chairs, you're correct. Somebody could purchase one of these and install it right now. And you're also correct that the exemption from interconnection and net metering would not exist. A utility company could ban these completely or charge someone additional money for installing these systems. And there are less guarantees that they would be installing a safe system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from the committee?
No.
Okay, I'll remove my objection to amendment number 3. Are there any further objections? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 3 is adopted. Co-Chair Holland.
Thank you. Chair Mears, I move amendment 4, work order 34-LS1203/A.2.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, Co-Chair Mears. This amendment provides clarification that electric utilities may require a customer to register a portable device with the utility through a simple registration process. This is addressing a question that's come up about what sort of controls would be in place around customers installing these. There's been some concern that on one hand, the intent behind this is to make this easy and convenient and affordable for people to be able to put a solar generation device in their homes. But on the other hand, there's been concern that while their intent is that this would be allowed, that perhaps utilities might want to be able to keep track of where these are at. So the intent is not to create an onerous process, but on the other hand, to give utilities the option. So the key word here is may require this registration process in there. It's not requiring utilities have to have it, but it is giving them the clarity that they can have this if they want, with this emphasis that it should be viewed as a simple registration process as opposed to something that might have required a more onerous inspection and approval and application process.
And I imagine that would be helpful to utilities to get at least the idea of uptake of the system, even if over time the exact location of them changes.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. I don't know if the bill sponsor wants to share any more about that, if you have any other background on this request and where it's come from.
Representative Ted Eichheit, House District 22. You know, part of what we've heard about this bill is people have fears about it, and so we're trying to address those fears. And I do know that my staff person talking to some utilities about this process of registering, some have said, no, we don't want to do that. So I think it's important that utilities are offered this option to address their fears. They want to perhaps measure, as was said by Co-Chair Mears, the uptake. To stay advised of how many folks are putting these in. The history from Germany is they did require registration, and 1 million of those units were registered, and eventually they just stopped they stopped that requirement. And that's why I said before it's estimated 4 million, but 1 million are registered.
Thank you, Representative Eichheit. And I think having that fall on the utility to make that decision, whether it's required or not, keeps our future legislative action out of it. Representative Ruffridge?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Mears. I have a couple questions. Excuse me. First question is, again, back to sort of the thesis statement of the bill. A portable solar generation device is exempt from utility interconnection and net metering program requirements. From my understanding of what those are, and this could be either for the maker of the amendment or the bill sponsor, that requires already some conversation between the utility and the person installing a solar device to interconnect and net meter. Is that correct?
Through the co-chair, that is my understanding.
A few follow-ups, if I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. So if you're already, by the very nature of, to be even included in the language of this bill, you have to say that a you're seeking to be exempt from interconnection and net metering. If you wanted to be included in interconnection and net metering, you would have to talk to the utility already, I think. And so that would be the impetus to talk to the utility is desiring interconnection and net metering. And then on page two of the bill, it says that part of this is may not. A utility may not require a user to obtain the electric utility's approval before installing or using the device. Sure seems like registering or may require someone to register runs directly in opposition to that line. So if this amendment is to move forward, it's probably for the amendment maker. It seems to contradict itself in the bill.
Representative Holland.
I want to take a short at ease.
Brief at ease. There we go. We are back on the record with House Energy Committee. I'd also like to recognize that we were joined by Representative Johnson a few minutes ago, and I don't recall if we recognized Representative Ruffridge.
I just showed up and started asking questions.
Well, yes. So, Representative Holland, now that you've reviewed the bill and the amendment, do you have a response for Representative
Ruffridge? I do. Thank you. And thank you for taking a brief break so I could work through the negatives and the positives of what is and what isn't. So just to, I think, paraphrase the question that came from Representative Ruffridge. He was observing that if we are looking at page one at the bottom, line 13, it says that electric utility may not require a customer of these devices to do a series of items that are enumerated on the next page. And the question was, is this amendment that we're now making that says a utility may require registration, is that in conflict with what we just said? And as I understand this, and with clarification from the staff that had legal review this, these are not in conflict with each other. The section B, beginning at the bottom of page one, is clarifying what a utility can't do with respect to these devices. They can't require approval, they can't charge a fee, and they can't require additional controls or equipment beyond what is integrated into the device. This amendment is saying what the electric utility may do. B is saying what they can't do. this new section is saying they have the option of requiring a registration. And to be clear, this registration is not in conflict with 1, 2, or 3. The registration would not be creating approval. It would not be creating a fee, and it would not be creating additional controls. So I certainly agree that these things are closely related, but I view them as independent and beneficial for the utility to have an option there to have registration if they would like it without conflict with what they're required to not do and be.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Ruffridge?
Yeah, thank you. And I see sort of the version that you're going with there, Co-Chair Holland. However, I think the paradox actually is found in the words of before installing or using the device. That's line one of the things that they may not do. And then if you go to the amendment, the key, I think, to the amendments not jiving is that the same language is in this amendment, that the registration process may be required before the customer uses the device. So if a utility says, before you use that, you have to register it with me, the customer is sort of forbidden from using the device, which in effect is an approval, which is forbidden in line one of the section of may not. So, and that says, obtain the electric utility's approval before using the device, even though it's a registration, because both of them contain the phrase using the device. It, in default, it becomes their approval if they require registration. And I think that there's an issue there.
Representative Holland?
I don't know whether the bill sponsor wants to take a shot at this. I understand, I think, your point, but I would interpret the language around registration as not being the same as requiring approval. Perhaps that's a legal fence to understand which side that leans on, but my understanding and the intent is that registration is really tied to this, you know, a clause at the end here that says that it's a simple registration process. There's nothing in here requiring approval in there, but
that the completion of the task is submitting a form, not getting even a verification of receipt of the registration, just that process has been initiated by the user.
That would be my understanding. And I guess I would hope that given what is in Section B that says the utility can't require approval, that it would be implied for consistency with the bill that registration couldn't be having an approval step in it. Otherwise, it would be in conflict.
Thank you, Representative Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair, I think the registration is a criterion that the consumer must do. An approval that we're asking that not happen is for the utility to approve. That's a decision. I see a criterion that the consumer must do if the utility wants to require it is not a decision by the utility itself. That's a yay, nay type of situation.
I appreciate that perspective. Representative Ruffridge, do you have more follow-up?
No, thank you.
Representative Costello?
Thank you. And, you know, the way I look at this is that the utility cannot say no, but they may require you to register. And I think part of the issue is that it's the amendment, that new section is not really enforceable. And I think the intent of it, if I might try to understand it, is the safety concerns. So I'm wondering if we've addressed those safety concerns in the previous amendment that we passed. Because the safety concerns seems to be the major issue with this new program or new device. So I don't see these two in conflict, but I do think that the second one saying that they may require, they're not going to say no, but they may require a customer to register. And then the question is, well, to what end? just general information about what customers are doing. If the device is truly safe, it seems like that then would alleviate any decision by the utility board to necessitate a registration process. So I just wanted to bring that up.
So I'd like a shot at that first before I hand that over to the bill sponsor. So there's other things that are important besides safety for a utility. So that is certainly a consideration, which I think we've taken care of in amendment number 3, but also what loads are on their system. Like if there is a concentration of these devices in a certain small area, kind of like way off on their grid, that might have some effects on how their system is running. So having knowledge of what the inputs are to the system is operational information. It's not safety information. And I think also just generally the uptake of like how many devices are on a system, how do we need to manage our loads on a large level too, would be important for the registration. Representative Aisha, do you or your team have a response to that?
Just that I thought that was very similar to the response I would give. It's just information that they want to help them better understand things.
Representative Costello?
And it's my understanding that the power output is not that significant. Can we pivot to a discussion about what kind of power output we're talking about here? If you know that in Germany, or, you know, Germany may not be the exact comparison we want, but what are we talking about in terms of home use? Why are people buying these? What are they using them for? Is the limitation that we amended earlier, is that sufficient? You know, what's the nature of that?
For the record, Aaron Callahan, staff for Representative Eschide, through the co-chairs, Representative Costello, I think a good way to go through this is to first say that this is more of an offset for the power used in your home than it is to be thought of as a typical generator. I have some examples for you. A laptop, for example, uses 75 watts of power. One panel could power about 5 laptops at a time. To go to the other end of that, a clothes dryer uses about 5,000 watts, and you would need 12 plus of these panels just to run your dryer. Does that help?
I'm looking at Representative Costello because it appears you might be formulating another question.
Chair Mears.
Representative Holland.
Yeah, let me take one more shot at this. So the maximum allowed on any meter, a home, is 1,200 watts. That is 10 amps. Most single circuits on a home are 15 to 20 amp circuits. A hair dryer is 1,200 watts. This is basically a hair dryer in a home, in terms of the impact that it would have on what it would offset.
So there are further.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Further question from Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah. I Co-Chair Hollins, I would like him to repeat what he just said, that none of that didn't make sense.
Sure. So the bill, as amended, allows a maximum of 1,200 watts. 1,200 watts on a 120-volt circuit is 10 amps. Most household circuits, if you go to your fuse breaker, probably is a 20-amp circuit. So this is roughly half of the power that would normally be on a circuit. For point of comparison, a typical device in a home would be a hairdryer. They are typically 1,200 watts to 1,500 watts. So the output of this device would be roughly equivalent to the power of a hairdryer, or half the amperage of a typical home circuit.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. I was...
I just heard hair dryer, and then I was connecting it to the solar panels, and I got confused in there somewhere. So thank you for reiterating that.
No worries. I was jumping back and forth between amps and watts and power, and it's okay.
Representative Eichheit. Yeah.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears. Through the co-chair, I think you've already adopted an amendment to limit this to in total 1,200 watts of power generation. That's under perfect conditions, clear skies, generally cool temperatures, pointed directly at the sun. Usually these will generate less than that. And it's just a small part of your home's electricity ecosystem, if I may. And you have devices that are almost always pulling power from your system. And I heard the question, why would someone do this? To essentially reduce their draw from the grid, which will lower your energy costs. So hopefully that answers the question.
Representative Eichheit, Representative Ruffridge.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Mears. I'm going to come back to it. I don't think I'm going to be supporting Amendment Number 4, and for a couple of reasons. As I understand the intent of the bill, it's actually to make plug-in solar power somewhat available to the consumer, have it be as safe as anything with electricity can be. I think some of that has to be left up to, the individual choosing to plug in a solar device into their home to make decisions about how that should go, whether that's on its own individual circuit, which is probably what I would choose to do, or plugged into their outlet. I think the idea of having them take any additional step, whether that's registration or some other sort of thing, kind of runs into the problem of not being in the And I think the intent of the bill, I do have some of those safety concerns. I think 1,200 watts is not, as Representative Holland said, a whole lot of power. It is one that you probably need to have those certificates or underwriting to, be in place at some point. But I think people are using these now. I don't think that this bill is about forcing safety requirements either. I think it is asking for them to be exempt from interconnection and net metering requirements if they meet certain criteria. And I'm satisfied that the criteria here is small scale, easy to install mostly, and shouldn't take those additional extra steps. I think that's the intent of the bill. So I won't be supporting Amendment 4. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions from the committee?
I've got a question to Representative Ruffridge. I think it was an interesting thought that staff has asked me about is, would it be helpful to amend the amendment to drop the language around before the customer uses the device? Representative Ruffridge, or is the concern more about the electric utility may require this registration, and then maybe this doesn't address your concern?
But yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Holland.
Interesting suggestion.
Yeah, I think certainly that would help. I think a little bit to alleviate the concern. I think if this was obviously a larger scale, we already dealt with Amendment Number 1. I apologize for being late. That was actually one of my questions, and I appreciate that amendment coming forward to talk about chaining them together, because that was obviously a option with solar generation is chaining them together. And I didn't know if the maximum power output mentioned in the bill originally was the whole system of 1,200 watts, or if it was each individual panel, which I think are usually 400 watts, and then I could chain them all together, and I could have, I could have a lot of watts and I could plug them all in to a whole bunch of different things. And so I feel a lot more comfortable with that. I think the idea of registering it, if a utility wishes to have a registration program for portable solar, they can do that. Nothing in this bill, they don't need this language to do that. They could be, just very clearly offering that as a registration there, or they would like to know. And I think that it just doesn't need to be in the bill as a thing. Because once you take away the, you can't use the device without it, then it just becomes a voluntary registration program, which probably doesn't need to be in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, but we have utility people here. We could ask their comments on it. I mean, if they wish to comment. Rather than Representative Rufford speaking for them, mm-hmm. They could. Do they have any comments on it?
Brief at ease. We are back on the record with the House Energy Committee. There was a query from Representative Kopp if folks that might represent utilities in the office would like to speak, and that was declined. So we are back onto the conversation for questions and discussion on Amendment Number 4.
A question I have.
Representative Kopp, then Representative Costello. Okay.
This amendment appears to be purely permissive in nature and not declarative, and doesn't appear to be requiring a utility to do anything they would not otherwise probably pursue. We're just making it clear that they're allowed to require a registration if they choose to do that.
Was that just a comment, or do you have a question for someone?
I'm asking the maker of the amendment.
Yes, that's correct. This is providing clarity, given the prior section, which said a bunch of things that utilities can't do.
Right.
This is providing clarity that if they wanted to, there is the option to have just the registration, and with the clarification that it should be a, quote, simple registration.
Right. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Costello.
Thank you. I guess my preference would be is that we avoid putting extra language in statute that is already allowed. And then my earlier comment is that it's not really something you can enforce anyway. So if it's, to me, if you leave it in there, it's not something that they can enforce. And if they were to try to, or if it's misunderstood, I think it then just becomes a section that's not necessary to put in here.
Which one?
Yeah. Representative Holland.
Yeah, thank you for the comment. I guess, I would suggest that if we don't put this amendment in, it would be, I think, relatively easy, as our earlier discussion already identified, to read Section B in a way that would suggest that if a utility tried to ask people to register their devices, somebody might read Section B and said, no, you can't do that. Section B says you can't put any of these requirements on this. And this amendment was trying to provide the option only for a utility to have clarity that if they wanted to, they could have registration. But without this, Section B would be perhaps leading somebody to believe that they couldn't do that. This is giving them the option that they can if they want to.
Respond.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. I think it's clear that it's approval, which means they could say yes or no, but perhaps the legal drafter could clarify that, because there's a difference between asking somebody's approval and then just asking to be informed about something. So I think it's clear that they're not able to ask, to have to gain approval. The homeowner is not having to get approval from the utility.
We can take a brief at ease and get legal drafting on the line in order to address that.
Okay.
Brief at ease. We are back on the record in House Energy, and on the line we have Ian Walsh from Legislative Legal, who is the drafter for Amendment Number 4 to House Bill that we're discussing right now. Mr. Walsh, we are parsing some words here in the bill. I think Representative Holland has got a good summary of our question here and is ready to ask it.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Mears. Mr. Walsh, we're currently debating Amendment Number 4, which is an amendment that is offering the electric utilities the option or the may require a customer to register a portable generation device before they can use a device. However, you know, we have in Section B, prior to where this is going to be inserted, some language around the electric utilities may not require, and specifically in number one, they may not require approval. So we're having some discussion about, you know, how does the option or the requirement in B that says they can't require approval, how does that work with potentially this new Section C that says they may require registration? And there's been a little bit of discussion about the difference between approval and registration. And would this be clear if we added in Amendment 4, or is there something that is inconsistent?
Co-Chair Holland, I believe the question is a little bit more specific. Is this language necessary in order for a utility to request registration from folks? So, Mr. Walsh, I hope you've followed that and can help enlighten the committee.
For the record, this is Ian Walsh, Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair to Representative Holland and to Chair Mears, I believe I followed the question. So I think what this amendment would do is both provide clarity, and it also has one other effect. So it would clarify that the electric utility may require a customer to register the device. And I do think there is a distinction between requiring registration, which would be something where the utility would not have the option to decline. So it's not an approval requirement, it's just a registration requirement. And then what it would also do is it allowed the electric utility to have this registration requirement before the customer uses the device. I think nothing in the bill as it stands would prevent the utility from having a voluntary registration requirement. So the utility, without the amendment, the utility could say, if you have this device, we ask that you register it. But I think the bill could be read to prohibit the utility from preventing the customer from using the device before the registration. Whereas under the amendment, the utility could prevent the customer from using the device before registration, and it would be clear that that's the case. Without the amendment, I think the utility could do the voluntary registration, but it might not be able to prevent the use of the device without using the registration process, whereas the amendment allows the utility to prevent the use without registration. I hope that makes sense, and I'm available for other questions.
I've got a question on a slightly different tangent. Are there further questions from the committee? So my question, Mr. Walsh, is if a utility requires registration, then they are also required to provide a method for that registration. So you can't require registration, then not provide a method in order for that to happen, in order to be a roadblock for use of a device.
To the chair, this is Ian Walsh. Yes, I think that the utility under the amendment could require a simple registration process. And I think given the interaction between, as Representative Holland mentioned, B1 and the what would be added as C in this amendment, it couldn't be a process that would require approval, but it would be a process that would require some sort of information from the customer who's using the device. And it would have to be simple. What that means, of course, would have to be sort of operationalized in practice. The amendment doesn't provide any other specificity besides simple.
Understood. I just kind of wanted that clarification out there if anyone was feeling a utility was feeling like they didn't want these, that they couldn't provide a paperwork barrier by not providing the paperwork. It was a bit of a tangent, but are there further, thank you very much for your time and attention today, Mr. Walsh. Are there further questions from the committee on amendment number 4? Okay, I will remove my objection to amendment number 4. Can you say that into the microphone?
I object.
Thank you, Representative Ruffridge. We have an objection to amendment number 4. Ms. Cole, can you please take a roll call of the committee for the adoption of amendment number 4?
Representative Call.
No. No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
No.
Representative Costello.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edgemond. Co-chair Holland.
Yes.
Co-chair Mears.
Yes.
2 yeas, 4 nays.
And with a count of 2 yeas and 4 nays, the committee has failed to adopt amendment number 4. So we have gotten through our amendment process today. At this time, we will set the bill aside for further consideration. And we are now on to House Bill 369, Energy Electric Utilities, sponsored by this committee for the first time. Co-Chair Holland, would you and your staff please approach the bench, introduce yourselves for the record, and begin your overview for the committee? Thank you. Please proceed.
Great. Thank you, Chair Mears, and to the committee. House Bill 369, the Energy Affordability Omnibus Bill, as we've been referring to it, is a bill that, for context, is primarily focused in on a series of policies related to diversifying the energy options and infrastructure that we'll be investing in the future. This bill comes from the work we did in the last session. There it was contained in House Bill 153, which was focused in on renewable portfolio standard language. We learned a lot in the process of that bill about both the value of diversifying our energy, the importance of looking at new energy sources and the new technologies that are being adopted throughout our country, and indeed new technologies that are providing affordable new options that we have seen are stabilizing prices in areas that would otherwise be exposed to volatile pricing. The debate that we had on that bill, though, also identified a series of challenges with an RPS type of standard, particularly the way the RPS bills in the country and this one we proposed had both some incentives, but it also had some penalties or sticks associated with the goal of a portfolio percentage penetration. And in that original bill, we had, as is seen in other bills in the country, some fees associated with not reaching the portfolio standards. And we were, you know, looking at those concerns. We also heard other concerns about whether or not the bill had sufficient flexibility to support other sources of diversified energy. We put the bill on hold last spring with the intention to come back and take that input and incorporate it into some improvements. And rather than continue with that bill in 153, which was originally my intention, we decided to develop that as a new committee bill, and that's the bill we have here. What I would like to note is that this core focus on supporting diversification of our energy is one that incorporates a lot of what we learned from our work last session, and specifically incorporates many of the proposed amendments, including the minority amendments that were being suggested to improve the bill. Removing the penalties was something that we did, including options for nuclear power. We've included, including options for clean coal, we've included, including options for being able to accept that if a large pipeline is built and provides us with a significant amount of very affordable natural gas, that that would be an alternative that would make this portfolio unnecessary. That's included now. But in the meantime, we've also learned a lot about other policies that would be supported by the utilities and would be potentially valuable for ratepayers in being able to control the future increase in prices and the security of having a reliable source. So this new bill is one that incorporates what we learned. It incorporates the feedback and the concerns that we had with the prior legislation, and I think represents a strong integrated approach to our future energy. And I would just wrap up my opening comments by noting that while a lot of the focus of this diversified portfolio standard addresses power for the rail belt, I think it's always important to remember that what happens on the rail belt is also directly having an impact on what happens in rural Alaska because of the connection of the power cost equalization program. To the degree that the power costs in the rail belt go up, that reduces the benefit and the affordability of power in rural Alaska. To the degree that we can hold down the cost of power on the rail belt, we also benefit holding down the cost of power in the rural communities because of that PCE linkage that uses our rail belt power as the baseline cost of power. So this is about improving the reliability, the affordability of power across all of Alaska, though we will begin getting into the specifics as it relates to many policies that have more direct applicability to the rail belt. So thank you. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Tim Truer's staff, who is going to be able to work through giving us today kind of a broad overview of this bill. We'll be coming back to it over a couple future meetings to kind of dive into some of the pieces of this. Today, we just want you to kind of see the big picture of what's in this bill. Thank you.
For the record, Tim Truer, staff to represent Holland. Thank you, Chair Mears, for the opportunity to introduce House Bill 369. Turning to the PowerPoint presentation on slide two, this is a big bill under a single subject of energy where all the pieces directly or indirectly touch on energy affordability. Though the official title is Energy Electric Utilities, I've been referring to it as the Energy Affordability Omnibus. As Representative Holland mentioned, you know, the genesis of this bill connects back to House Bill 153 and some of the lessons from last session. There are also some other specific pieces to this that are drawn from other existing pieces of legislation. On slide three, still on slide two, despite the length, I will do my best to keep this introduction brief. As the committee has already examined many of these pieces as independent bills, and because we're not trying to rush this bill through the committee, and because we anticipate gathering considerable input and further additions or changes to the bill before we move it out of committee. On to slide three. And then before diving into the sectional analysis, I do want to add some quick context for the bill. As the committee has heard, in Alaska, you can find communities paying more for energy than any state in the country. We're looking at a natural gas shortage that's going to lead to a large rise in the cost of electricity and heating for the majority of Alaskans. And the changes that we will have to make in order to account for that are likely going to link us to a volatile commodity market. Alaska, we're a state that prides itself as an energy producer, and we will likely have to begin sending money out of state to import liquefied natural gas to meet our needs. The different pieces of this bill addresses these issues in various ways. And I want to spend a minute highlighting one of those pieces, the Diversified Portfolio Standard, which is at the heart of this bill, as indicated by Representative Holland. On slide four, so we've now adopted the term a diversified portfolio standard. Diversity in, for energy is important in two ways. One, diversifying energy, diversifying a portfolio is a hedge against volatility. But also, when we look at, as we go through it and see, the specific types of energy resources that count towards what we're proposing as a diversified portfolio standard, they're all clean and they all offer stable pricing. And it's just one data point to show the impact that those resources can have. I will bring forward this figure. It was presented by the Kodiak Electric Association at the RE Plus conference in Anchorage this fall. And what it's showing is that for Kodiak, for their grid, it lacks the economy of scale of the rail belt, but nonetheless, they're able to offer their electricity in the green line on the graph at a stable price. And it's actually, this is not corrected for real dollars. So the real cost of electricity for Kodiak residents has actually declined through time, while it has risen for all of the major rail belt utilities over the last 25 years. And that's largely thanks to embracing two of these specific energy resources that count towards this diversified total, those being hydro and wind. Moving on to slide 5. I also want to highlight just how much the diversified portfolio standard section of this bill has evolved from its origins in House Bill 153. So we've simplified the target from two different targets at two different dates to just a 40% target for diversified energy resources for electricity power generation, I went with the date of 2036. That will give us 10 years if this bill is passed this year. Going into what counts towards these targets, the RPS versus the new DPS. Previously, it was just renewables. There are a few multipliers that kind of changed to what extent you counted different renewable sources. Now we're looking at those renewables, hydro, wind, solar, geothermal, also nuclear, also things like clean coal. So fossil fuels clean and producing the type of energy that's attractive to for economic development opportunities where developers are typically looking for new clean energy resources. It also, as Representative Holland mentioned, counts gas that would come from a gas line from the North Slope, like what we would see with a phase 2 project that's been proposed for Alaska LNG. And it keeps some of these multipliers adjusting some of them slightly.
Is there going to be an opportunity to ask questions afterwards?
Representative Johnson, can you please use your mic?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there going to be an opportunity to ask questions after the presentation?
If you've got a quick clarifying thing now, please do, but we'll want to get the brief overview.
Well, my question on fossil fuels with greater than 100 kilograms CO2, I don't know, whatever that is that a standard definition for clean coal? Or whatever clean coal means. I guess that's what I'm looking for a definition on.
Representative Johnson, thank you. I believe there's a couple of different definitions for clean coal, but Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I would like to come back to you with more information about how this meets different definitions of what clean coal or what counts as clean coal. I think chair is right.
Thank you.
And I'll just get very briefly, like carbon dioxide emission is one, and sulfur is something that's more commonly and historically used within the industry of clean coal that we've used in the state. It's a more updated and modern definition, I think, that we're moving to that goes beyond sulfur content. Please proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Chair Mears. And then a major change also for this bill is the carrot and stick mechanisms to ensure compliance. Previously, there was fines in House Bill 153, the RPS standard. Those have been removed. Primarily, what we're looking at with our diversified portfolio standard is the benefits that it can provide in shaping the IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan process through the Rail Belt Reliability Commission. It's preclearance of projects that meet certain requirements in advancing this utility's progress towards the standard. And it's also, something important to highlight about this new bill and the current environment that we're in is that we believe that some of these statutory targets, even if they don't have a strong financial enforcement mechanism are still important as something that we can point to and that utilities can point to as we go through things like negotiations over potentially long-term LNG import contracts. Moving on to slide six, we're going to start the sectional analysis, and I will go through quickly, noting that we don't have too much time and we would like to save some time for questions. I will gloss over some of the specifics on the slides. Happy to dive into those later, whether during this meeting or another. Slide seven. So section one of the bill updates our energy targets that were set in 2010 when we last updated our state's energy policy. This is uncodified language or uncodified law, legislative intent. It also makes clear that our intent with the diversified portfolio standard is not to raise costs of electricity compared to the counterfactual scenario where we do not have a diversified portfolio standard. Section two then is essentially the contents of HB 257, which we just heard, including the amendments that were adopted. Slide eight, section three creates an economic development rate that lets excess renewable energy. So for example, excess hydro power that might be available in some communities in Alaska. It allows it to be sold at a discounted rate for economic development projects. Section four parallels the language from SB 32, allowing electric utility boards on the rail belt to vote to establish small renewable projects that are under 15 megawatts in generation capacity without having to get the explicit approval from the RCA through a rate filing. Slide nine. We're now getting into the diversified portfolio standard section. So section five requires is the requirement that the IRP satisfy the DPS. Section 6 and 7 allow for pre-approval of large energy projects that are consistent with achieving the DPS. Section 8 adds definitions relevant to the Diversified Portfolio Standard, or DPS. Slide 10. Section 9, now we're into the meat of the Diversified Portfolio Standard. It's defining a target, how it can be met, what counts, what doesn't. I won't go through all the details here now, but I do want to highlight that the that this is where energy sources like nuclear and natural gas delivered through a phase two gas line are named as diversified energy sources under this standard. There's also some specific criteria in this section for how fossil fuel sources like clean coal can meet this threshold for counting towards the DPS. Slide 11, section 10 now moves on to the Renewable Energy Fund. Section 10 changes the date at which the Advisory Committee for the Renewable Energy Fund would report their application rankings, their list of applicants' recommendations to the governor, moving it forward so that it's in time for the governor's budget development process. Section 11 borrows language from House Bill 196, adjusting how that REF, the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee, operates. And then sections 12 and 13 now point back to the Diversified Portfolio Standard, closing a loop on the Department of Environmental Conservation's role in determining whether the criteria, those specific criteria for clean coal and other fossil fuel projects, and whether or not proposed projects would qualify towards the DPS. And then finally, slide 12, section 14 finishes updating the state energy policy through the section that is in statute, a number of goals that don't quite have the same quantitative targets attached to them. And then finally, section 15 establishes the effective date for the bill. And with remaining time, we welcome any questions, noting also that we would be happy to follow up and get additional answers to you and provide more information at a future meeting date. One final note is that there, we do expect already some additions to this bill, our intent is for House Bill 252, the Electric Utility Right-of-Way Bill, Wildfire Risk Bill, to be added in as a piece of this in a future date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Holland. This is a lot of pieces in here, and I think the amount of time we allocated for a brief overview was we will definitely need time on and offline to delve deeper into it. So I know it was a lot, committee members, to absorb right now. Any clarifying questions at the moment? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Co-Chair Mears. So I guess, I mean, some of the pieces that we see included in this that maybe aren't there yet, I understand some of these, and some of these we've talked about, like plug-in solar today. Obviously, the main, probably contentious point, just from my perspective, is going to be the diversified portfolio standard and what gets counted and what does not as diversified portfolio. And I guess just reading through the bill, there's a couple of things that I just jump out at me right away for questions, which is first thing, multiplier for wind projects. So it seems like this is sort of trying to pick maybe a winner or loser in what we consider diversified. So that was one question. The second question is the way that this bill deals with natural gas. Certainly, I'm a big fan of moving forward with a pipeline. I think a lot of people in Alaska are, but there's also a lot of other places that make natural gas, including in my home area. That seems to be noticeably gone from the bill. So I guess those are my initial questions, and I probably have more after that.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you for the questions. I think to kind of briefly touch on the items you've raised, I guess I would begin and suggest that I hope this does not need to be viewed as contentious, quite frankly, to use that word. The goal of 40% is a goal that if you if we were to go back and look at the testimony and the work that we did on 153, the utilities were essentially already nearly at 40% by 2030. Their plans are already fully consistent with diversification. We have utilities that are looking at solar projects. We saw in the news recently utilities that are developing hydro projects. We have wind projects being developed. I think broadly we'll see that the strategy of moving towards diversification is already well established, well accepted, and well underway at this point. And 40%, quite frankly, is not much of a stretch goal. This was essentially where we were a year ago with the plans. Now, admittedly, with the ITC, PTC tax credit changes at the federal level, some of those projects slowed down and they've been put on pause. But I think the intent of diversifying the source of power has not slowed down, and the news, I think, is consistent with that. But we can continue to dive into that, and I'm sure we'll have more testimony to be able to discuss what 40% is. I do anticipate, though, one of the questions that will be brought to us is whether or not the target date of 2036 is the right date. Some of the projects, for example, hydroelectric projects, may take longer than 10 years to be developed at this point, and they are seen as very attractive projects. So we may see some debate on, is that the right date for that target? The multiplier on the wind projects, I think, has been constructed and vetted through 153. We went through that pretty thoroughly, particularly as it relates to the large nameplate projects and trying to encourage the investment in those large projects. And this was an incentive to actually encourage multiple utilities to work together to build projects that were beneficial across the rail belt to do that. So, but we can come back to that, but it did get some debate and some consideration in terms of why that was beneficial for that. As far as the natural gas, you know, there's two sides to that. We certainly recognize that if a large phase two project came along and we had substantial, very affordable gas, we'd want to use it. And I certainly agree that if we can see a gas pipeline built, and I hope there might be a gas pipeline, we would all benefit from that. So this bill does provide that option. But as far as other gas options, whether it's the current Cook Inlet, whether it could be other fields, that's not gone. This diversified portfolio standard is seeking 40%, not 100%. So there's still 60% that is available for supply through whatever means necessary. So I think the hope from my standpoint is we'll continue to see Cook Inlet development we'll continue to see the other fields in the Kenai Peninsula still be a vital long-term source of energy for us. This portfolio standard 40% is intended to protect that option, not preclude it.
Do you have a follow-up?
Oh, yeah, please.
Representative Ruffridge, okay? And yeah. Just for awareness, Representative Kopp is also in the queue.
Okay, thank you.
And we're closing in on time.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Mears. So I appreciate your answer specifically on the natural gas component. I think the area that I still probably am going to seek clarification on, we can do this offline or in a later committee time, is you are counting as diversified energy natural gas that comes from the phase two pipeline, whereas nothing. So in other words, if you build that pipeline, everyone will meet the portfolio standard, diversified portfolio standard, if they're using natural gas from the pipeline. It just seems like a, I don't know, sort of a give to natural gas, saying, well, we kind of want that, but we only want that one. And that seems odd to me. I was just wondering if you could speak to that.
Representative Holland, briefly, right. Please.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think the key message here is that if phase two comes along, we are anticipating a substantial reduction in natural gas pricing. And it is under that basis that that gas gets some preference. Any other option I'm aware of that I think we, you know, heard any testimony on is attractive but expensive.
Representative Ruffridge.
Except for cooking that natural gas right now. That's all. Just a comment.
It's fine. Current contracts have not been particularly cheap there.
We'll let that be for the moment, Representative Kopp.
So, Madam Co-Chair, I feel like I want to disclose to the committee that in my private sector, I do public communications for the Rail Belt Reliability Council. So that helps pull all the utilities together to which they already are. The legislature established the Rail Belt Reliability Council for the purpose of putting together an integrated resource plan, which coincidentally will be coming out months from now. And all the utilities are working cooperatively on that. And so I appreciate the bill sponsor's effort at constructing a bill that actually touches on a number of the things that the RRC is addressing now. But I just wanted the committee to, number one, understand that I'm helping with public relations for the RRC. And they can, you know, talk about it when we get to that point. But the initial concern I have is that we're saying that we're basically predetermining the outcome of the integrated resource plan before it is complete. So we're kind of putting the policy cart way ahead of the engineering horse, so to speak, in section 5 of the bill, where it says that the plan must conform to the diversified portfolio standard. And so I'm just concerned that these guys are working really hard, and we've established them as a legislature to do this job. They're pulling this together. The plan's going to be coming out in a few months. They're working with all the utilities, and so that's my more of a caution than anything else of being prescriptive.
Thank you, and we are over time. Something brief, Representative Holland.
Very, very brief. I appreciate Representative Kopp's comments. I would just observe we have been discussing this with the RRC. They are aware of this. There is an intent that what we have offered here is compatible, acceptable, and consistent with what the RRC and the IRP is doing, including the dates that we have here. And love to come back to it, but I'm offering this with the intent that this is consistent, compatible, and supportive of the IRP process.
Good. I'm sure they'll speak to it. So, but thank you, Representative.
Thank you. So with that, we will set this bill aside for the moment for future consideration. And that concludes our business for today. Just a reminder, our final finance subcommittee meeting is on Tuesday, so our regular committee starts at 1:30. On Thursday, we are scheduled to start back up again at 1 o'clock, but of course, we've got floor next Thursday, so we shall see what entertainment that brings us and our start time for committee next Thursday. Thank you all on that. We are now adjourned at 3:02 p.m.